This is Junk Food Cinema.
This is a podcast, a junkie podcast, and we've got one for you this week. Oh my gosh, so excited. Welcome, junkies.
Yeah, welcome to what essentially was going to be a two-movie podcast, but due to miscommunication, is going to be a two-parter. Yeah. This is a very, very special Summer of 87. Very special because not only are we talking about one of the greatest science fiction movies of all time.
Had it not been for this movie, we would have gone from Summer of 86 to a random assortment of movies for the last few months, because this is one of the tentpole releases of 1987 that makes 1987 so incredible in the first place.
And we have an amazing guest to cap it off. So this is going to be a very exciting show. So why don't we get it the fuck started?
Let's get it the fuck started by telling you, you can find our back catalog on iTunes and Stitcher, or you can go even further into the back catalog at Libsyn.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, Facebook, Facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema, Patreon.com. If you decide you like this podcast and you'd like to buy each episode for a dollar, literally, you can go to Patreon.com/Junk Food Cinema and pledge to be a patron. And for that, you will get access to all of our bonus content. We really appreciate that. I'm Brian Salisbury, and with me, as always, is a novelist, a screenwriter, Lieutenant of Megaforce, a man who just bought himself a very nice 5000 SUX, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going great. Even better, because one of my longtime friends, a person who actually is kind of personally responsible for this fucking show existing, a guy who's done crazy shit in his own right. He's a magician. He is a podcast show host. He is a TV show host. He is Brian Brushwood.
Man, when you run it all together, it sounds almost impressive. Freaks me out.
You do the same thing to me. Like, I got a message this week that some 11-year-old kid thinks I'm one of his heroes because not only did I write a Doctor Strange movie, but I helped Brian Brushwood make a magic trick. And he's like, that's the coolest thing ever. And I'm like, that just warms my heart that you put it together like that. That God bless you, son.
You know, that's one of the weird things. Like, when you finish, because I spent 15 years touring all over the United States with the Bizarre Magic Show, and the last thing you want to do when someone comes up and asks for an autograph is make them feel anything less than awesome. You know what I mean? It's Arnold Schwarzenegger used to, when he would meet people, the story goes, he would be very down to earth or whatever, and people would walk away disappointed because they didn't get the Arnold Schwarzenegger experience. And so then he started putting it on all the time. So, like, as a result, whenever now I'm in the weird space of like no, own it. You did a thing. Quit making people feel bad for saying it.
And you did a thing well over a decade ago. This is way back. You and I were sitting in a bar, Opal Divine, second story. We're swapping stories and drinking beers. And you say to me, Cargill, why aren't you doing this film critic thing full time? Why are you still working in a video store? And I was like, well, you know, money, and it's not really paying. And he said, you said, here's what I did. And maybe this will work for you. Maybe it didn't. But me and my wife, we sat down, we talked about it. He said, you want to do this magic thing? You want to entertain full time? I'll give you a year. I'll work. I'll pay the bills. You give it a year. And at the end of the year, if you can't make a living doing this, then you go back, you put on a tie, you manage a tire store. And then by the end of the year, you were booking shows, you were making money. And she goes, okay, I'll give you one more year. And I talked to Jess about that. And Jess was like, you know what? I can give you a year. You can get a year to see if you can make this film critic and writing thing work. And sure enough, I took the year. That was 2006 that I took the year. I started in January. By April, I was making more money than I was making at the video store. By the end of the year, I was making a decent living. She goes, okay, you get one more year. And by the end of that year, I was making as much money as she was, and it was off to the races. And now here we are. But I would not have gotten there and not been able to start this show if not for several beers, if I recall, we had back in the aughts.
Dude, that makes my day to hear. And here's the funny part, is the goal of me saying that to you, or at least when I thought it to myself, was not so much like, oh, I'll become a success because somebody's taking care of me for a year to get started. Yeah. The goal was, you know, I was working a day job where I was surrounded by people who were broken and had dreams at some point, but not anymore. And I realized I'm on track to very likely spend the rest of my life wondering what might have been. at least let me spend a year. Worst case is I rack up a bunch of debt and I just become like everybody else. But at least in my heart, I know that I tried for it, you know? And so, in your case, obviously, it worked out okay. Congratulations.
It worked out okay. I have a podcast. I've done some things.
Prime directive number 5, when you jerk each other off, make sure that you're not using the robot arm, because that is actually very dangerous.
Robot arm? What a segue.
Right.
What is our film this week, Brian, everyone that didn't click the link that says RoboCop?
Well, yeah, it's like, come on. You know what movie we're talking about by now. I want to know, back to your story for a second, if you ever got confused and wore a tire to manage a tie store, because I feel like that could be a natural mistake that you can make.
I think you have to wear a barrel.
Oh.
Not a tire. I think that's the...
you want to
wear a barrel around
hobo.
My spare tire.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Fashion Hobo is the store I worked at.
Fashion Hobo. patent junk food cinema. We are definitely opening a store.
So this is... Let's move in. We're almost half a bottle into our bottle of scotch that I opened for this episode. We are drinking scotch with a special guest, and we've got fucking RoboCop to talk about, people.
I'm so excited. And I'm excited that you're here, Brian. But when he said that we were having the person on who might be responsible for this podcast, I didn't know we could book Jack Daniels. But apparently... you can do that, so that's really impressive.
Dude, we are not drinking Jack Daniels. We're drinking Edredor.
No, a little further up. The nose needs to go a little further up when you say...
I had my pinky out while I said it, motherfucker.
All right, Mr. Nanny, calm down.
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to do this episode as a double feature, if possible, which we're ending up not doing, is because when I saw this movie, I've talked about this all summer, this is the event that crystallized me as who I am. My parents are big movie nuts, and we used to have a movie night every Saturday night where we'd rent a movie from the video store, we'd make homemade pizza, we'd watch a movie. They would take me out to movies all the time. They would let me go to drop me off at the movie theater on base so I could watch movies by myself that they didn't want to watch. And one weekend, they go, hey, we're going out to the drive-in theater. We were living in Tucson, Arizona at the time. They go, we're going to the drive-in theater. And I said, ooh, what are we watching? And they go, we'll tell you when you get there. And I was like, oh, fuck. In my head, I'm like, it's going to be one of those adult movies that just is boring. It's going to be Out of Africa. It's going to be, a movie I don't give a fuck about. Maybe I'll like it. I don't know. But they're like, we'll tell you when you get there. And we pull up, and I shit you not, I look out at the marquee, and it has six things, six different screens playing. But one of those screens, I knew it. I fucking knew it. It was Masters of the Universe and RoboCop.
We've got to volunteer. The body is on the way. As you know, we've entered into a contract with the city to run local law enforcement.
We were able to save the left arm.
What? I thought we agreed on total body prosthesis, not lose the arm, okay?
We get the best of both worlds. Onboard computer-assisted memory and a lifetime of on-the-street law enforcement programming.
Hey, Louis, it's SuperCop.
This guy's really good.
He's not a guy, he's a machine.
What are they gonna do, replace us?
Murphy, it's you.
Go get him, boy.
Thank you. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. Anything you say may be used against you.
You better back up, pal!
Your move, creep.
The future of law enforcement. RoboCop.
Thank you for your cooperation.
And so here I am, 1987, I am 12 years old, and my parents have taken me to a drive-in theater to watch Masters of the Universe, followed by RoboCop, and it blew my 12-year-old monkey mind.
Just hearing that lineup, I'm sorry for the audio problem there, was my erection knocked over the mic stand, because that sounds fucking amazing.
It was, and so I watched those movies sitting out on a warm Arizona night, in a folding chair, listening over those tinny old fucking speakers, watching it on a big fucking screen in the open night air. And it was just, it was amazing. It was one of those, it's one of my top five movie experiences of all time, is seeing this double feature as a kid. Like, you cannot ask for a better experience to experience those movies and together. And the delightful dumpster fire that is Masters of the Universe, backed up with the amazing, mind-blowing, keep in mind, I am 12 years old.
He said it. Everybody, take that soundbite and use
right
it
now.
Yeah,
right
I am
moment.
12 years old.
Yeah.
And I am watching the opening scenes of this movie where a guy gets gunned to shit by an Ed 209. I have never seen anything like this before in my life. And the movie just keeps going.
Yeah. So, the first thing that occurred to me was like, thank God you saw it in that order, right? Because it's like, you know, oh, Masters of the Universe. What are the white sticks? They're bones. Oh, they don't eat meat.
Well, that was the old methodology of how they would do it. Is they would show that if the movies were of different ratings, they would show the PG or PG-13 movie followed by the R, so that families could go home if they just wanted to see the one movie
sure.
with the kids, or that the kids would be passed out by the second movie so that mom and dad could enjoy RoboCop. But oddly enough, that experience, I'm watching RoboCop and I look over in the screen next to us playing Witches of Eastwick.
Well done. Another Summer of 87 alum, Witches of Eastwick. Well, since we've got the hobo fire going and we're telling stories, Rushwood, do you remember when you first saw RoboCop?
Yeah, man. 1987, I lived in Norway. So all of a sudden, like around 1986, I was 6th, 7th grade. You know, you get a chance to reboot your life in middle school. And I was a dorky kid during elementary. But then, you know, I was falling in with the cool kids in middle school. And then we moved to Norway, Stavanger, Norway, place where we got one English language television show, The Cosby Show, with Norwegian subtitles. Which is contextually different nowadays. But so very little stuff made it through. And in fact, it was during one of my brief visits back to the States where I got to see RoboCop and I had, my brains exploded. And keep in mind, at the time there was heavy censorship. They wouldn't show it. So I watched RoboCop twice in 87, once maybe in the theater, I don't really recall, but I certainly remember watching the heavily edited version that was available at the movie rental store.
It was 12 minutes long.
Yeah, dude, it was very short. It was pretty crazy.
So did they ever? So when you're watching this movie, were you constantly interrupted by an old man saying that he'd buy that for a crone?
By the way, can we start with that?
Let's do it.
That's
sure.
My one favorite artifact out of this whole thing. I want so bad to meet that actor. I want to meet the set designers, the folks who walked out with videotape and recorded all those. Because that's clearly a Benny Hill kind of nod homage in the future. I want to know how they sat around smoking cigarettes and deciding what they were going to do with that.
Yeah, it's. I'm glad that's where you're starting, because one of the things I read while doing my research on this is that apparently the inimitable Nancy Allen, who's amazing in this movie,
and who, by the way, did an interview recently for
80s All Over.
Yeah, our sister podcast, 80s All Over. If you love RoboCop, if you love Nancy Allen, she does a whole long interview with Drew and Scott all about all her various work in the 80s, but spends a lot of time talking about RoboCop. So if you ever wanted to hear her talk with a couple of nerds like us about fucking RoboCop, go over, support the Patreon. If you're not listening to 80s All Over, fucking listen to 80s All Over.
Why don't you do it?
But become a patron, check out that interview, because that interview is fucking great.
But her first day on set, they were filming the I'll Buy That for a Dollar interstitial, and she looked at the quality of what was going on because
it's intentionally bad. She thought it was a disaster.
She thought, oh my God, what did I sign up for? What is this movie?
I've made a huge mistake.
Not knowing that it was going to be one of the many media breaks that, and that is a good place to start, because those media breaks are part of a larger kind of pastiche of why this movie is perfect for junk food cinema. Because it's a movie that double dog dares you not to take it seriously.
Well, and this is something that I needed to talk about here. Paul Verhoeven, to people of a certain age, is known as a big tentpole science fiction director of an era. And that's never who he was. He was that for a small window of time. He made science fiction satires. He made four science fiction satires in a window of 13 years, in between a bunch of psychosexual thrillers.
And by the way, all of them hold up as best I could tell.
No.
Wait, because you said four, but I'm thinking of three.
You're thinking of three. You're not thinking of Hollow Man.
Oh, shoot. I never saw Hollow Man.
But that is a psychosexual thriller.
It is both. It is both a psychosexual thriller and one of his science fiction satires, because he's not taking the science fiction seriously. That's the thing about these three pinnacle films that he did. Of course, RoboCop, followed up by
Total Recall,
and then followed by Starship Troopers. He was making satires that are so enjoyable because, as ridiculous as the stories are, he goes even more ridiculous.
So here's the weird part is, as a kid, I was, I don't know, what 13-ish, 12 years old enough to recognize satire when I saw it and understand that they were sending a message. And at the time, I thought they were cliche or heavy-handed. I'm like, oh, come on, it's not going to get that bad. Living in the 21st century, let me assure you, they were slightly less than prophetic.
So let me try and paint a picture of the dystopia that this movie, you're going to have to go way out on a limb. Detroit has completely collapsed into economic turmoil.
Already
something,
yeah.
Something we have talked about, especially in the early days.
Is Detroit?
We have not talked about this in a while, but one of the important things to know about this particular period in the 80s was the crime statistics were getting worse every year. And up until 1992, murders were going up in this country, crime was increasing in this country, and there was a very real feel that the world was going to hell in a handbasket and something needed to be done.
All Detroit has a cancer. Cancer is crime.
And this is how the right managed to rise during this period of time, because people were scared. People legitimately thought the cities were going to crumble. You could go into certain parts of New York and there were buildings that had just collapsed that nobody fucking bothered to rebuild. They had not started rebuilding yet. And so there was a thought that places like Detroit and New York City were literally just going to crumble into dust and were going to be crime-ridden hells.
And yet also this was a time of huge economic development. This is around the end of the 8 years of Reaganism. And this was in many ways kind of a backlash against the corporate culture. The idea of privatizing, that was one of my favorite scenes rewatching it today, was when he gets up and makes a presentation. He says, OCP has gone into a bunch of areas that people said only governments could go into. And he starts listing them off, and then he gets space exploration, and very literally describing the actual world.
Traditionally considered not-for-profit was how he phrased it.
If only he had said prisons, he would have nailed everything about our era.
Well, and the weird part is, I'm not gonna pretend like we live in a dystopian future. I mean, it seems like
it's not like we have a game show host as a president or anything.
Okay, hey, we haven't gotten a Running Man yet. You calm down.
but it's amazing. Those were certainly the fears, and the fact that some of them sounded so outlandish at the time, and yet definitely have happened. Speaks to the. Do we know who wrote this? Of course, I'm sure somebody knows. I don't know who wrote it, but I definitely love the fact that they got so many things exactly right.
It was Ed Neumeier, actually. And the funny thing about Ed Neumeier is, you're right, he absolutely nails so many things about this future and the corporate society and corporate culture and just the idea of profits over people to the nth degree. But he kind of latched himself onto Paul Verhoeven like Quato, because his other writing credits... His other credits.
I wish I had three hands.
No, was that not his line?
That was not his line.
He only needs two for Verhoeven.
So he wrote Starship Troopers as well, and then kind of coasted for the rest of his career on writing. He wrote the RoboCop remake, and he also wrote a lot of the Starship Troopers
sequels. Did he write the RoboCop remake, or was he just credited
Omen? No. Because he got character credits on things like the RoboCop versus Terminator Sega game and the RoboCop TV series. But when it comes to RoboCop 2014... I think you're right. He may have just been credited because he wrote 1987.
Because they did that with The Omen, too, where they literally like, well, let's just reshoot the movie with the script. And so they had to give credit to the screenwriter.
But all of his credits are either RoboCop or Starship Troopers related in some way, except for Anaconda's The Hunt for the Blood Orchid. But that's not important right now.
Because what is important is remember that name, because eventually we will cover Hunt for the Blood Orchid.
Take a drink?
Because have you seen Hunt for the
Blood Orchid? No, I haven't seen Anaconda Hunt for the Blood Orchid.
Oh my God. It has the greatest animal character of the modern era. There is a monkey in it who is the captain's monkey named Kong, who keeps getting put into danger with the Anaconda, and you love him more than the rest of the cast?
I am glad you mentioned monkeys, because...
Monkeys?
Monkeys... A planet where podcasts talk about monkeys? It's a madness. No, do you know who was originally supposed to direct RoboCop?
No.
Jonathan Kaplan, who directed Project X.
There you go.
He walked away, and they went through literally every other available American filmmaker that they could before they got to Paul Verhoeven, who'd been making movies in Holland. Yeah. And according to, by the way, I have, not to brag, guys, I know you're bragging about all your success or whatever, but I do happen to own the single disc Criterion release of RoboCop, on which there's an amazing commentary where Paul Verhoeven says, and I want to know more about this because he just leaves it on the table like it's not a big deal, I couldn't get movies made in Holland anymore because of the government. What does that mean?
What it means, if you watch any of his films from Holland, they're not nice, easy movies. They deal with some fucked up stuff. Like we said, psychosexual.
I'm sorry, what movies. Was the movie that he was getting a lot of attention for last year?
Oh, L?
There you go.
Oh, no. L is tame compared to stuff like Turkish Delight.
Well,
like,
and keep in mind, so he was making movies in Holland, and it was the Holland government that mm-hmm. had a problem. Dude, I understand that by the time, the RoboCop cut I saw in Norway was 20 minutes long, and rather than cut to black or whatever when they're running over a toxic waste covered dude, they just didn't even get show there. The scene.
Wow, they so they edited that much, more like Scantanavia. Sip,
mic
sip.
Drop.
I can't. No, don't drop. Those are expensive. Okay.
Yeah, no, they're not. This is not an expensive podcast.
Patreon.com.
His early work was really racy and really, he was a filmmaker known for his audacity. And so when he came over to work in the American system, it was like, oh, what's going to happen? And sure enough, his movies pushed the envelope. In fact, the only tame thing he did during that entire time was
Showgirls.
No. No, that's it. Just I keep, for some reason, I don't know why I keep
the other dystopian film.
I don't know why I can't get the words Total Recall out of my mouth
because
today.
You, like, it's you just literally total, can't remember the words Total Recall, and I'm you don't expect the me words to pick up on the irony recall. Of that.
I do not.
I'll remember that title for you wholesale. At
you beat me to it. Yes, damn it. Cheers.
Yay, Phillip Scotch. Day,
Dick. Wow, you guys really know your dick.
And no one is listening anymore. Thanks for trying.
Can we talk about the over-the-top violence on there? Because
we're about to celebrate the over-the-top violence.
Well, and the thing is, as a kid, you're struck by the viscerality of the entire thing. And as an adult remembering it, I was just like, oh yeah, that was probably gratuitous for the sake of being gratuitous. But watching it again, it's like, no. It's important that the people at home know that Murphy is dead, so very dead. He's totally dead. That's why everything is missing off his body.
Oddly enough, the version that we probably all watched was not the theatrical version. They altered it when it went to DVD.
Really?
His arm coming off and his hand actually exploding were not included in the theatrical cut of that movie to avoid an X rating. But once it went on DVD, the standards of violence had changed and they knew they could get away with it. They did it, apparently resubmitted it, and it exists as the version we see now. That's not the version we saw. The version we saw that, like, really, the grossest thing in that original version is the guy getting gunned to death by Ed 209, which now when we watch the rest of the movie, that and, of course, the toxic waste splatter, which is so over the top.
Well, yeah.
Sure. At that point, it's a little bit cartoonish, although it did not feel cartoonish when I was a kid. But, that scene where where they're at the boardroom and the guy dies, just so classically late 80s disregard for human life. Everyone shrugs. Everyone's more upset about the mess than the death of a colleague.
Mean, the thing is I think what really sells that scene is the old man.
Dan O'Hurley, he from Season of the Witch.
There it is. He just face palms. Like, the way he facepalms in that scene where he's like, I can't believe I'm watching this. This is a total disaster. You can't really tell if he's upset with the loss of human life or the failure of the product.
See, and that's what I mean by this movie daring you not to take it seriously, because it really does throw a lot of over-the-top exploitation things at the screen. It's called fucking RoboCop. Like, everybody who read this script read about 20 pages and threw it away. Like, that's why they had such a hard time getting a star. But the thing about it is, the violence in this movie is not exploitative at all. It's making a point about the fact that in corporate culture, life is cheap and it doesn't matter anyone.
And at the same time, this movie is a satire of superhero films before superhero films were popular. Like, he was satirizing comic books. One of the things that's interesting, Peter Weller talks about, was in the script, RoboCop is supposed to move, is described as moving like Spider-Man. He's fast, he's agile, he's quick. And then they developed this great-looking RoboCop thing, and Peter Weller couldn't fucking move in it.
Couldn't move, couldn't see. That scene where he walks off and says, and they're like, hey, give him a car, and they throw keys and he intercepts it in the air. Apparently, that one scene took the entire day to shoot.
Yeah, because he couldn't, it's rubber gloves he's trying to catch it with, so it just kept bouncing off.
And he couldn't see out of that visor. So they ended up changing it and making it look more robotic, and they decided to turn into the skid. And by turning into the skid, they go, well, what if we teach you how to move like a machine? And he trained with, I think it's mimes.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
He told this story when he came to town a few years ago, and I think it was mimes he worked with, yep, who taught him how to this body control. And so he started doing this thing. And once you added the sound effect, all of a sudden, RoboCop was born. The RoboCop that was supposed to be in the movie never would have worked. And instead, because of tragic failures, we ended up with an icon of an icon.
Icon!
Icon! Of the 80s. That word came out just all wrong.
How's that Scott Street in you over there? I'll buy that pronunciation for
$1. This is one of my favorite scotches, actually. This is a really nice scotch.
he subsists on a very simple formula of scotch.
It's like baby food. Yeah.
This scotch, it is an icon of Scotland.
And there go the last three people listening. But no, you're right. It was a mime, actually a mime coach that he originally had to work in the other suit that the great Rob Bottin described as, it looked like somebody threw
third
up on a...
Third time we've mentioned him this summer?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Like, this is a summer we've mentioned him, and we're about to, in a few minutes, mention someone for the second time that I can't wait to talk about.
Oh, absolutely. But apparently, Rob Bottin described the first suit as, it looked like somebody threw up on a wetsuit. So he designed the iconic RoboCop suit that I...
Wow. That's going to stick.
The head turning before the shoulders is basically, like, if you ever want to impersonate the way Peter Weller moves, move your head and then move your shoulders if you're turning left. Like, your head becomes the turn signal for the rest of your body.
Yeah.
That's basically how it works. And I love the way that they reveal it. If you watch this movie several times when they're revealing a new effect, they do it in pieces. You'll see over the shoulder, you'll see a foot, you'll see a reflection.
Obscured by the frosted glass.
And
yeah,
then you'll see the whole thing. They're building up to it so that it never hits you the way like an exploitation monster would, just like Roger Corman would just show the monster. There it is. There's the whole thing. It's scary, right? This was like a slow lead up to, like, the shot where his helmet comes off and you see his face. The first thing you see is his face in the mirror, which, by the way, apparently Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast is one of the influences on Neumeier's script. Yeah. So you have Sergio Leone, you have Frankenstein, you have Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, you have all kinds of, like, mishmash of influences coming together to make fucking RoboCop.
And you've got a director who has been directing films with these incredible sex scenes for 15 years, essentially doing a tantalizing reveal to a bunch of fucking 12-year-olds of fucking RoboCop.
Well, and by the way, standing in for those 12-year-olds are the entire police department, who are running around like crazed schoolgirls after the Beatles, you know, coming around to see that moment. He walks past out.
It's been a hard day's night.
Dude,
I don't run very fast.
You know,
I don't sleep. I am a robot.
The cops' parts in this movie are so fucking lean. There's like mustachioed Italian guy whose only job is to talk about striking through the whole movie. Like, he just shows up in every scene about the strike. They get such a thankless job, but what a great job they do as the stand-ins for our blue collar, you know, everyman characters.
Well, and the I think my favorite,
he's a cop, man.
I love the fever dream fantasy of RoboCop doing what everybody in the late 80s wished could be done to every criminal, and every, you know, this almost eroticized fantasy of, like, oh, in a rape, not only would he shoot him, he'd shoot between her legs, blowing off his balls,
which was Verhoeven's idea originally. The original idea was that he would shoot and graze the woman, but hit the criminal in the head, and Verhoeven's like, no, shoot him in the dick. And it's like,
yeah,
all right, that actually works a lot better.
No, in fact, that's one of the things about this movie, and this is what really needs to be said, is structurally, This is not, even though it's a superhero film, even though it's a satire, structurally, every beat of this movie is a revenge film. This is just a revenge film, beat for beat, dressed up with a lot of other things. It is a guy who, in the first act of the movie, gets fucking, on his first day in this area, gets fucking gunned down.
He gets chewed up by bullets. That's how you have to describe it, because he is a pulp of a human.
A very bullying scene. It is not just criminals trying to defend themselves. It is not just them. They are literally torturing this fucking guy and cackling and making jokes.
See, I got this problem. Cops don't like me, so I don't like cops.
At the age of 12, I understood that once a visible hole goes through your skull, there's not a lot of use in CPR. So the next like 3 minutes, I'm like, why are they can't? I know it's the future, but
because
he's
dead. We have to show that people kind of care. But at that last moment of like, all right, let's just blast him one more time and then call it.
A real ER team. That in that scene, they're using their real lingo.
I was wondering about that because there was I wondered, it sounded like all the rhetoric they were using was correct, and that flat deadpan running through the motions. You know, we all know this is real.
And here's what's really going to blow your mind. Apparently, Verhoeven asked him, the ER team, have you ever seen somebody as bad as this pull through? And he's like, oh yeah, we get people shot in the head all the time that pull through. They're not great afterwards, and they don't have all their functions back, but they live. And I'm just like, holy shit.
Yeah,
I've seen Regarding Henry. J.J. Abrams.
J.J. Abrams, there it is.
Wait, hold on. What did J.J. Abrams
have to do? He wrote it.
What?
Yeah, J.J. Abrams wrote Regarding Henry.
That's why every time Henry's like, I remember how to tie my shoe, there's these lens flares that are like all over the screen. It's crazy.
In the background. He's just painting. He's painting boxes of Ritz crackers with lens flares.
Yes.
Yeah, so
they belong to the others, as it turns out.
So this film, every beat of this hits all the revenge film beats. Like he goes, even though he can't remember his life, he goes back to revisit his life. He can't remember it. And then every single villain dies in a spectacular revenge film manner.
If you look at his arrest record since coming online, it's like three regular, bad guys. And then Clarence Boddinger's entire gang, like somebody should have put that
one
together.
By one. Like he could have at some point, got them all. And instead, they go about it like, well, the cocky black guy who's a total asshole,
the giggler.
Yeah, the giggler. Yeah.
Not a contagious laugh on the giggler.
No,
fairly annoying.
He gets shot and dies in the street as his buddies leave him. Then you've got the guy who would go on, oddly enough, to be on ER, which would be his biggest role. He dies, I like it.
Dude with the beard,
he would go on to be one of the chief surgeons in ER.
No kidding. Paul Verhoeven.
No.
Paul Verhoeven.
Total recall.
No.
Philip K. Dick.
With Miguel Ferrar's cousin. Miguel Ferrar's cousin,
Clooney.
George Clooney. Yeah. So he gets, dumped into toxic waste, then crawls around begging people to help him who won't fucking help him, and then gets mowed down by a car.
It's
and
my
splattered.
Favorite trauma movie. Those 3 minutes of screen time is my favorite trauma movie.
You know what? That is everything trauma ever wanted to do with a budget.
And
that is a very, very trauma, but with a budget. It is fucking great. And then of course, we get the guy who's, hanging out. He's just successfully fucked up RoboCop and he's like, yeah, Nancy Allen fucking blows up his shack like spectacularly. And then RoboCop, of course, gets the great kill on Clarence Boddinger. Like it is such a revenge film in he is not just killing these guys. He's killing them in a way that the audience can enjoy every single one in a very different way.
RoboCop is Robo Charles Bronson in this movie.
Oh yeah,
he's like death wishing all, including.
I think that's a great way to put it. He goes he starts with obey the law and then throws that out after he gets fucked up and he's like, fuck the law, I'm just gonna kill these guys.
Dead or alive, you're coming with me.
That all happens after he circumvents or I guess he never does circumvent the fourth.
No, because that's done by the old man at the end where he's, Dick, you're fired.
Yeah.
Thank you. By the way, can we talk about how deep the bench of villains is in this movie?
Well, first of all, we have to talk about, this is the second time we've talked about him this summer. We promised we would get back to him. Ronnie fucking Cox.
Ronnie Cox!
Who we talked about in the amazing 77 film for our Summer of 77 series on Patreon about the car.
And we also talked about in Lethal, or not Lethal Weapon, but Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Oh, God, this is the third time.
This is the second movie this summer he's been in a movie with the word cop in the title.
That's
all right.
Right.
Look, you got to hook me up. Talk to me about Ronnie Cox.
Ronnie Cox, of course, is Dick Jones. He's the villain.
You say that, but there are so many fucking villains in this movie.
Well, no, he's the villain because all the other villains work for Ronnie Cox.
That's
true. Clarence Boddicker, like, he's got a gang, but they all work for him,
I'm on Brian's side with this. It's like, yeah, he's the bad. He's more like the producer of the film. The director's Clarence Boddicker, right?
No.
That's who we're going to blame for the bad stuff.
Okay, that's like, yeah, that's like going after a director for choices that fucking the Weinsteins made. Like, that's, like, this is, the thing is that, keep in mind.
This is sticking now. I think this is a good metaphor.
Remember when Boddicker walks in to kill Miguel Farrar? He doesn't do it because he's the bad guy or he's getting anything out of it. He does it because Dick Jones told him to, and he's the fucking heel pops in the DVD, by the way, before there were DVDs, pops in the DVD of Dick Jones going, giving him the speech about, you know, we could have been friends, but this is how you had to play it, so.
Which, by the way, I don't know how somewhere between being 12 and being in my 20s, I missed the fact that Red from that 70s show was the most evil villain of my childhood.
I can't watch that 70s show. I can't, because I'm like, he's going to murder everyone in this
family. He walks in while they're smoking and goes, bitches, leave.
That's
really good.
Which, by the way, they then referenced in XXX.
Did they?
Oh, yeah. No, there's the moment where a German guy walks in and goes, bitches, come. And then they're about to do business and he goes, bitches, leave. And it's like, oh, that's your fucking RoboCop. All right, that's good. This is actually, let's deal with Clarence Boddicker for a second since you brought it up. There is a line of demarcation as to which you love more as to who he is. He is either Clarence Boddicker or he is Red from that 70s show.
Sure.
There is no, he cannot be both in your head.
Well, we need to settle this quickly because
I mean they're definitely two different people. I don't see what the problem is.
Well, we need to get on this because Tigers are playing tonight. Let's get it done.
And I never miss a game.
I never miss a game.
That was a weird moment.
Yeah, because it's like, at this point...
He's in a fugue state while sticking his fingers in the other man's wine.
That's what's so great about that scene. That's an actor's scene. Like, that is a moment where, literally, I guarantee you, that line was probably ad-libbed.
It was, in fact, according to my research, ad-libbed.
So what that is he's saying, I don't give a fuck. I am so chill right now that I don't even fucking care. Like, either we're going to do this or we're not. But I'm either going to a Tigers game tonight or we're shooting and I have an excuse.
Here's how good the litany of bad guys in this movie is.
Let's do it. You want to do this. You've already laid this out. I'm sure you've written it out.
When Connell fucking Cochran is the figurehead and like 15th worst person in the movie, you've got a pretty deep bench of bad guys.
You do.
Miguel Farrar. Kurtwood Smith, Ronnie Cox, Ray Wise is one of the members of the fucking gang.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me with this? It's unstoppable.
Ray Wise right before he would go on to Twin Peaks.
Yes, this is very true. And then, of course, Peter Weller and Nancy Allen, the two of them together, like, it gives the machine a heart. It gives the Tin Man his heart, the relationship between him and Nancy Allen.
And we've got, for the second time this summer, an angry black captain in Detroit.
Very much so.
By the way, even at the age of 12, I was really heartbroken to see him dressed down and broken by the OCP brass. When they came in and they're like, you work for us, shut the hell up, get out of my face.
That's why this movie, I really feel, works, by making the cops not the bad guys. Because in so much of what was going on in this period of history, and as we're dealing with right now, the cops are being portrayed as bad guys because of what bad cops do. And this movie does not have any blurred lines. There are no gray areas in fucking RoboCop. Like, there's no corporate guy who's kind of good and kind of bad. There's no cop that's kind of good or kind of bad. cops are blue-collar dudes. Blue-collar dudes are good. Fucking white-collar dudes are bad. Fuck you, corporate
the
America.
The cops are so blue-collar that, much like in almost every Paul Verhoeven movie, they have co-ed locker rooms and no one gives a shit.
Well, that's the
first time. This is the first time I'd ever seen that. I might have watched that scene an awful lot as a kid.
Rewind.
But that's,
I'm learning social commentary. Hold on.
The tracking's really rough in this part.
But that's one of the interesting things about Verhoeven was Verhoeven saw the future and saw that feminism would eventually bring inequality to the sexes. He just thought it would happen faster than it did. And so that's something that happens in his movies where he has this, we have eroded the idea of a sexual morality, eroded the idea of sex roles in America so much that now men and women just are roomed in the same place, and that's how it is.
Well, Prime Directive 5 was past the Bechdel test. That I don't know if that ever worked its way into the theatrical cut.
No, this movie does not pass the Bechdel
test. Well, they didn't follow Prime Directive 5, but it was the fifth Prime Directive.
It was proposed in a committee. It got killed.
It got killed much like that poor asshole who gets Ed 209. Speaking of Ed 209, we mentioned that Rob Bottin made the incredible RoboCop suit in this movie. We did not mention who gave us Ed 209, and that is, of course, Phil Tippett.
Phil Tippett, yeah. And I love Ed 209 so much. It's so evocative. But the brilliance of Ed 209 is not just that it looks cool. It's that it is the perfect example of corporate idiocy. Like, the thing is that the Ed 209 is totally ineffective and bloated for what it was designed to do. It cannot chase criminals downstairs.
But on paper, there's nothing better than the Ed 209. If you're a committee, it's like, well, more firepower. Yeah, more like a tank. Yeah, also a deep booming voice. Also a broken.
Big guns. You know, these are all
guns.
Yeah, and then it gets into the field, and it's like, it can't even chase RoboCop down the stairs. That's how silly.
It has a personality, too, because when it falls on its back and it can't get up,
it starts squealing
so
like
pissed.
A pig.
It is so pissed about it.
So as a kid, this was the emerging time when we were starting to see computer graphics used more often, so you could kind of tell, like, old movies like Sinbad or whatever had stop-motion animation, Clash of the Titans, and so on. So I was able to recognize stop-motion animation, and I remember in the theater thinking, like, that doesn't look very good. That looks like the old style of animation. And yet, as an adult watching this, knowing that this is of its time period or whatever, none of that bothered me. It still seemed big and imposing, and the sound design was extraordinary. That's the weird part, is watching 15 frames per second animation next to amazing, deep, rich bass booms and so on.
Well, and it also completes, this is Phil Tippett showing his trope, which is making creations with three toes. You got the AT-ATs, you got the Tyrannosaurus in Jurassic Park, and you got the Ed 209. It's weird, but it's like he has a monster foot fetish.
So there's a chance you guys might remember this, but I don't. I want to say that I was browsing through a Fangoria magazine right around this time, and it had mentioned that the Ed 209 was actually an organic, it was a recycle of the same bone structure as an organic creature, but I don't remember what it is. Does that ring any bells to you guys?
If that's a real creature, I don't want to live on this planet anymore. That is fucking terrifying.
I'm sorry, not a real creature, but a creature that appeared in other movies, like a horror movie or whatever, which made sense at the time.
You know how grizzly bears have those guns on their arms and they walk, they can't go
constantly
downstairs?
Constantly telling me I have 20 seconds to comply.
Yeah. First request, play dead. Second request, untie that bag of food you hung on the tree. Fucking bears, man.
This is a much shorter movie than I remember it being.
Yeah. It's lean.
It flies by.
It is so lean. And that's the thing, is that's what really caught me off guard. Like, I always knew there were revenge elements of the film, but rewatching it, it is beat for beat a revenge film. Like, there are no subplots to this movie that don't revolve around the creation of RoboCop or him murdering all the people responsible for his death.
I mean, basically, the first act is a three-act structure of new guy gets beaten, killed, and rebuilt, and is now awesome.
Or as it would be in a 70s movie, killed and left for dead.
Sure.
And then he's not really dead. He comes back, but everyone thinks he is dead. And then he comes back and starts getting revenge.
But there's not much of a middle act. The middle act is basically him walking around his old house saying, like, oh, I used to be a person.
Yeah, well, the second act.
I think that's line for line what he said.
It's not wrong.
If I'm being honest, Brian Brushwood, your Kurtwood Smith is slightly better than your Peter Weller. Just going to throw that out there.
Yeah,
fair
it
enough,
is.
Fair enough.
It is. No, it is. That second act is entirely about what the hell is RoboCop? What is he going to do? And how is he going to affect the city? And how is he going to affect all of these criminals that we've set up in the first act?
But the whole second act is maybe 9 minutes long. Is that an exaggeration?
It's an exaggeration because, first of all, the end of the first act is the death of Murphy. And the go ahead of him being brought on as RoboCop, and then RoboCop shows up.
Hold on. I'm not saying you're wrong, but explain to me how.
I am arguing with
the end of the first act. I mean, enlighten me on how the end of the first act is the lowest point of all for the main character.
The end of the first act is never the lowest point. The lowest point is always at the end of the second act.
That's what I'm saying. It's like
the end of the second act.
The first act. The end of.
Okay. According to Joseph Campbell, when is Murphy in the belly of the bot? That's what we need to know. That's what we need to discern before we figure out where the end of the first.
No, because the low point of this movie is when RoboCop goes to arrest Dick Jones and discovers the fourth directive, and where he cannot do it, and he goes and starts getting shot up and beaten to shit and is blown apart, and Nancy Allen has to save him while the police are chasing him trying to kill him. That is the low point of the movie.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good.
Murphy is killed, and they decide to go the go ahead, and we're building RoboCop. We have been promised what RoboCop is. We know he's going to be RoboCop, and the second act is entirely what is RoboCop? How is RoboCop affecting the plot of this movie? How is RoboCop going to destroy the intricate plots of these various criminals, which are steal money to buy drugs, sell drugs to make money, and essentially take over the old man's job. These are very convoluted plots that are being interrupted by a guy who can sniff out bullshit and cannot be bought, which is essentially what this is. You were really right to bring up Paul Krasarsky. Paul Kersey.
Prime Directive 1, shoot you. Directive 2, shoot you again.
That is...
I just want to see Charles Bronson as RoboCop.
Throw another one on the check box.
That is who he is. He walks in and he gives you one chance, and if you don't take it, he's fucking Ed 209. Like, that's one of the weird things about this movie is RoboCop is only better in Ed 209 in that when you put down the gun, he will then throw you through something and say thank you for your compliance.
So I know we're going outside of RoboCop 1, but there's a few most of RoboCop 1 sticks with me, but there was one scene in RoboCop 2 that when I went to see RoboCop 2, I was really frustrated because they kind of undid the whole ending, right? The triumphant end is he remembers that he's a man named Murphy, and he doesn't
What's
know
your name,
what he
son?
Is. Murphy, right. And he's going to discover, he's beginning a journey of self-discovery and he's going to kill bad guys along the way.
Ironically, the other possible guest for this show was Jason Murphy. Ha! And while watching this, I'm like, why are we having Schwitty on instead of Murphy, for the Murphy?
Also, thanks for being here. This is not normally how we treat our guests when they're nice enough to show up.
They wanted the other guy. What the fuck, Carter?
No, it's fine.
We have gotten so hammered so many times in our life that I can bust this man's balls.
And this doesn't even make the top 100. But in RoboCop 2, they undid that. Much like the end of Karate Kid, it's like, oh, he's going to get the girl. First scene of Karate Kid 2 is like, hey, that girl is a bitch, right?
That happened in every Karate Kid sequel. Every Karate Kid sequel started with him not having the girlfriend from the movie before.
Which makes me think that Danielson was just the worst fucking boyfriend ever.
Could be. But there was one moment during episode 2 of RoboCop where she goes...
series?
Before we get there, I just have to say, I am the man who will fight for your honor, and then I'm going to say, bitch, get me a sandwich and a beer. Okay,
so,
continue.
So you remember his partner, Murphy's partner, I've forgotten the character's name. What? Lewis. Lewis shows up, and she's still obsessed with, like, don't you remember being Murphy? All right, but meanwhile, they've wiped his memory, and he leans forward and shows his face and touches it, and she's like, oh, it's cold. And he goes, they did this to honor him. I can't. Like, that was such a great moment of breaking the canon before that, because up until then, I had assumed that was his real face up until that, but it's like, no, all of this is dead.
What I think is funny is that Nancy Allen's amazing as Lewis, but the person who was supposed to play Lewis was Stephanie Zimbalist, and she didn't get to because Remington Steele called her back, which effectively means Remington Steele ruined two careers at the same time, because this is the same year that Pierce Brosnan was supposed to start as Bond, and Remington Steele at the last minute, he's literally walking out the door to the press conference, goes, oh, hey, good news, we're doing another season, And Pierce Brosnan just was like, fuck, and walked back in his hotel room and had to wait till 95 to be James Bond.
He said, maybe in the meantime, I'll have Robin Williams throw fruit at me dressed as a woman.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah, because that turned out bad for him. Yeah. Wait, are you hating on Mrs. Doubtfire?
I'm not loving on it.
But dude looks like a lady.
We couldn't tell which of you were directing that hatred at.
Yeah.
That disgust.
Yeah, it's a movie. That's all I'm going
to
say.
Do I have to put this on the redemption list? I
mean, you might have to.
I mean, look, all of Timothy Dalton's Bond years could have been avoided. That's all I'm saying.
Yes, this is the darkest timeline, is what we're getting at. Much like we're now living in Detroit.
Yeah, because we don't already live in the darkest time.
We're living in a time when they need a fucking Delta City, because I will tell you this much. I would rather live in the Detroit of RoboCop than the actual fucking Detroit.
You're setting up RoboActor. The world is destroyed. People are demanding high wages. They're all podcasting. We need a robo actor.
I'm telling you, that RoboCop remake was like 2 years too soon. If they did a RoboCop remake now,
oh my god, it would be huge. You could double down on everything. In fact, you could actually just add some CGI to the original, re-release it, and call it a brand new movie.
Can you imagine the media breaks that would be in that movie? Like, you could just...
It would be actual media breaks.
Yes, it would be things that are actually on TV right now. I am very excited about this. I am sorry that I'm yelling.
This episode brought to you by Scotch.
This episode brought to you by Shouting. I'll buy that for a dollar.
I'll buy that for a dollar.
And I think I had a game as a kid called Red Alert. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, dude, Red Alert was meant to be shocking, that they're all like, you know, I'm cutting off your supply lines. Ah, you crossed the Maginot line. I'm going to nuke you. Like, that's real life now.
I've played board games with people that are exactly like that now, so I'm not sure that one really lands, but I do love all them. In fact, one of the greatest, this is why you have an editor moments of the movie, is that line, call me Murphy, is one of the best final lines of a movie, and then they just drop the title card, da 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 da, it's so triumphant.
Which, by the way, I didn't know that I knew the RoboCop theme until I watched it again. I was
it's so iconic
theme, yeah.
I used to have a joke in the moments where he was like, because they do like a sad version of it too when he's in his house, and I'm just like, I am a robot, a crying robot. It's like the sad, like, ballad version, but... Originally,
yeah, you're right. They do really
to vandalism for the salesman.
I know that realtor comes in the next day, like, what the fuck? Did the robot police officer come in here and punch a wall? That's literally the only scenario I can think of.
Dude, no, because they couldn't have done that because they had already left all this trash and there were like dead flowers and burnt pictures and books and shit. Like, nobody cleaned that fucking house before they sold it.
Very poorly staged. Can we critique the real estate?
The realtors, in this alternate reality fucking suck.
Can you imagine walking in and she's like, well, this is a $100,000 bad memory that you're
buying. You go in and you bake cookies beforehand so the house smells like baked cookies.
By the way, the small choices I thought were fascinating in there, like you're going to do a family vignette, and so you have the mom, the dad, and the child, and of course, you know, it's Halloween. If you notice, the pumpkin that she's carving is not a jolly pumpkin. It's got wicked, evil, slanted eyes and jagged teeth.
Well, and the kid
is dressed like Satan with the goatee and the horns.
Holy shit, I never noticed that.
Yeah.
It's very unsettling, and it's framed as a poignant moment of remembrance, but instead it is deeply unsettling.
Yeah, it's kind of weird how they play with his memories like that. Like, that's one of the weirder parts and the most Verhoeven, honestly, I think the most Verhoeven thing in the movie is the original memories that we see of him are all, like, almost negative about his family. Like, it's his son saying, you know, watching this TV show and kind of pining for, hey, dad, are you even that cool?
Yeah, right?
It's his wife jumping up and go, I have something to tell you. And then, of course, later, you know, it's like, I love you. And then they get down to
some robo fucking.
They're being playful
Prime
in that
directive
moment, but,
69.
But we see fragments of it, and the fragments are not positive. And then when we get to this one positive memory of them taking a picture together, yeah, there's this sinister fucking pumpkin and a son dressed as Satan, and it's almost like he's very much in an artistic way going for a disconnect to his past.
I'll tell you where else you see that is he's either having a remembrance or a dream sequence when he's remembering driving off to his first day at work, and you have the picturesque moment of the cul-de-sac and the family there waving him off. But instead of waving the way a human would, you know, side, 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 you get this Stepford Wives, you know, very slow left, right.
Well, that's foreshadowing.
And then it
robot.
Rapidly right. pulls away and just races away from the house.
Yeah. In fact, I kind of want to go back and watch all of those scenes, because I'll bet every single one of them was intentionally framed as if it was positive, but everyone has a sinister element.
Yeah.
Hot take, I don't think Alex Murphy ever wanted to be a father, because there's a moment later, even after he started...
All right, new dad.
Hold on. There's a moment where he's regained his humanity, and he's doing target practice, and he's doing target practice on a bunch of jars of that baby food that they feed him. Paul Verhoeven found a way, this is so fucking sneaky and awesome, found a way for RoboCop to shoot babies and get away with it in a theatrically released movie.
And had you cheer it on.
The smiling faces are front and center on those jars, and he's just fucking trash blowing them away. And then you think about when he remembers his kid giving him shit, dressed like the devil. I don't think he likes his kid. I'm just going to throw that out there. Prime Directive 6, fuck that kid, apparently. No? Okay, fine.
I'm sorry. I multiple interpretations of the phrase, fuck that kid.
Oh, yeah. Don't buy that for a dollar.
Wow.
It got darker than I thought.
Yeah, wow. you can go to Thailand and buy that for a dollar.
Help Jesus Christ. Me. Help me.
Consumerism.
Get off me.
I do love the fact that they very quickly, in a very short amount of time, set up a consistent world with a consistent set of consumer triggers. You know, when they, among the other things, when they have a hostage negotiation situation and they're talking about the SUX 5000.
And then, of course, you've got that great scene with the heart transplants, and it starts as a very medical thing. It's like, we've got Yamaha, choose your heart.
Oh, boy.
By the way, the actual way advertising in the 21st century work.
By the time this episode posts, that might be a fucking reality. That's as political as I'm gonna get, guys, but that whole interpretation of like every single aspect of medicine is now completely privatized and corporate, and it's all a big business. Yes, that's kind of already how it's been for many years, but it could be RoboCop level, Verhoeven level by the time this posts. That's all I'm gonna say.
A lot of over-the-top guns. Mm.
So many. The Desert Eagle, that's an automatic that he's using.
Yeah, well, and plus
first of all, I don't know if this is intentional, but the Cobra,
I was going to make a Cobra, when we were talking before about, I think, Rushwood, you were saying that this movie is like an eroticized version of what cops would like to do to criminals. And in fact, that was one of the concerns Verhoeven had when he actually showed this movie to cops, and he was worried that they would feel demonized. And the reaction across the board was, oh, this is awesome. This is exactly what we wish we could do, which reminds me very much of Cobra in 86, which is Stallone in a movie that is that reaction to a perceived liberal approach to crime.
Yeah. So no, this is again, part of the right wing pro-fascist concept of throwing law and the legal protections out the window for the bad guys, because the bad guys are hiding behind these and they're using these as shields. So fuck that. We're going to go right to the source and just fuck these guys up. We're going to walk into a Coke factory, and rather than arresting everyone, we're going to shoot everybody. Like, everybody in this fucking place is going to get shot. But you know what? It's okay, because they shot first because they're the bad guys. Like, everything he does, like, even...
Yeah, just like Han Solo. All the bad guys shoot first.
Oh.
Wait, what? What? Oh. What? Oh, it's true.
Yeah. You know what? We mentioned this in passing. I really want to highlight this. Ronnie Cox. No. We talked about how deep the bench is, because the bench is really deep. Like, seriously, this is when it comes to villains, this is an actor's movie. Like, the actors in this film, you know, you talk about Peter Weller, you talk about Nancy Allen. There's not a deep good guy bench, but dear God, the villains in this movie are fucking amazing actors. But Ronnie Cox, I want you to consider, if you've not rewatched RoboCop recently, I want you to reconsider watching The Car and RoboCop back to back. The Car, 1977 film we talked about on our Patreon podcast. It is a phenomenal Jaws knockoff that is just amazing. But Ronnie Cox plays this alcoholic deputy who falls off the wagon halfway through the movie when he realizes he's fighting a demon car who's killing half of his fucking department. And he is so good.
His alcohol is spinach that allows him to defeat him?
Kind of, but except the thing is that he's like, he literally, like, there's a moment where he realizes the kid who lives next door, who he's become the de facto dad to, may have been murdered by this car. And he's been sober for 2 years and he starts sneaking drinks at work. And he goes out on a call drunk and he has to admit that to the sheriff. And it just, like, it is so wonderful how Ronnie Cox, how delicate a job Ronnie Cox does. Watching that film back to back with RoboCop and seeing how he chews up scenery deliberately as Dick Jones and seeing the subtleties that he puts into the various scenes and how good an actor this guy is. Like, you remember him. He probably, this might be the movie you remember Ronnie Cox as Dick Jones, and seeing the subtlety in the acting and seeing how great an actor it is. Ronnie Cox did not get a lot of chances to make great, memorable films, and watching these two show you how amazing and versatile an actor this guy really was, and really makes you loathe Dick Jones even more because you start noticing the subtleties of him. Having seen three of his movies this year,
well, and there's almost a moment of tenderness when they meet in the executive washroom for the first time, Bobby and Dick Jones.
Oh, yeah.
And Dick Jones is like, "Oh, I understand.
I used to call the old man names. Old iron butt.
And
then what? And he almost lowers his voice. He says, "One time, I even called him an asshole." You know,
but there was always respect.
Why are you touching me with your voice?
Yes,
which is what he's doing.
It really is.
And then he totally steals that moment from Miguel Ferrer. And then Miguel Ferrer steps up and is full Miguel Ferrer and takes it right back and says, "Fuck you, Ronnie Cox. This is my scene, not yours." Like, that's the actor scene of this entire movie. Like, those two guys in the washroom going, "I'm a better actor."
First thing they shot, by the way. Very first scene they shot.
By the way, whatever happened.
That's awesome to know, by the way.
Okay. When I was 12, I had Showtime. I had HBO.
We get it. You were rich as a kid.
You had skin. You jerked off to softcore at 1 a.m. on Fridays when your parents were asleep.
So by the time I was 12, watching RoboCop, I'm like, "Oh, cocaine. That's that one thing everybody does when they're evil and grown up, or good and grown up."
Yes, anything grown up. That's what cocaine was, the grown-uppest thing
you could do was do cocaine. And nowadays, not so much. You don't see that.
To doing cocaine off between the breasts of a model?
Speaking of failing the Bechdel test, I want to mention just a few things here. A box of Reese's Pieces, a 4-pack of Big Red Gum, a 100-sheet composition notebook, and a bottle of Louisiana hot sauce are all things that in 2017 you can still buy for $1.
I'd buy that for $1.
In case you were wondering. I also want to mention
that
the fact...
That was a great line, for the record.
I also want to mention the fact that this would make a great double feature with Blade Runner, because apparently where Neumeier got the idea for the script was watching Blade Runner and watching a world in which cops chase down robot criminals and thought, what if we just reverse that where the cop was the robot and...
Except that the cop is the robot, Neumeier.
Or is he, depending on which of the 15 versions of that movie you watch?
There are like three.
Hey, speaking of which, 100. Real quick, there's one throwaway line that I totally missed every time I had watched it up until this last one. That moment when Dick Jones is saying, like, "Hey, man, this bullshit of doing crime on the streets in old Detroit, this was a test bed. I had military contracts lined up. This was an instrument of war.
Yeah.
Who cared if it works?"
Like, yeah.
That moment.
25 years of replacement parts.
Yeah. He already has a pipeline all the way down. And it's like, and what's weird is in that moment, I could be all like, "Yeah, dude, you kind of fucked up, because like this could have been a giant thing that would allow America to win all the wars."
Wait a minute. So he was selling a technological product full of bugs that he knew people were going to have to update every year. I was wondering why Dick Jones was wearing a turtleneck and jeans.
But later he's going to cure malaria. Don't worry about it.
Wow. I love how you guys crossed the streams there about two of the great villains of the 90s who are lionized today as great capitalists.
Wow. Hot takes all over the place. Turn down the temperature.
But I want to mention the fact that the one effect in the entire movie that I don't think holds up is I refer to it as stretch Cockstrong, when Ronnie Cox gets pushed out of the window and for some reason the CG clay version of him that's falling has enormous arms.
I did notice that even as
he looks like Freddy Krueger.
You know, I actually ended up watching this back to back last night with the 1986 forgotten classic Link.
This is junk food cinema. There is no such thing as a forgotten classic. That is our job. We will remember it for
you
wholesale.
Have you seen Link?
Have I seen Link? No, I've played as him.
See. Yeah, this is a movie. Everett DeRoche wrote a movie in 1986 in which Elizabeth Shue is terrorized by a cigar-smoking, suit-wearing orangutan who kills almost everyone in the movie.
And there's the second time the mic stand's been knocked over by my throbbing erection, because that's a hell of a log line.
And both of the movies end with the villain, like, falling terribly with that same effect. And so you have the Dick Jones falling out of the window.
Is that not the name of a porn star?
With the
I'm
same
sorry,
effect of a suit-wearing orangutan falling into a building full of fire. And it was just like, this is the best synchronicity I have experienced.
We could do an entire show on weird falls of final villains, because Randall Tex Cobb in Blind Fury comes to mind, where he like falls apart Darth Maul style.
And then the
down.
Best ever, Hans Gruber, just a year later in Die Hard.
For sure. For sure.
Although that was pretty solid. I mean, outside of...
No, that's the one done right.
Yeah.
That's, like I said, it's the best one. But yeah, no, it's a very weird effect that was actually the exact same effect as used in Link in 1986.
Well, it's because, much like Alan Rickman, they didn't tell the orangutan they were going to start dropping. They went on two. So that reaction on that fake orangutan's face is very real.
I can't wait to the day you watch
Alan Rickman?
Link.
Yes.
Oh, brilliant.
Hello, I'm an orangutan.
Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
And that brings us to
the junk food pairing.
This one, I realized that being in Austin...
Oh, fuck. You already tried to make me eat baby food once. Are you going to do this shit again?
I'm not going to do that again. I did actually do a baby food pairing once, and I made both Cargill and our guest eat it. I'm not going to subject you to that.
It was Murphy, I think, wasn't it?
No, I think it was Joe Lynch. The point is, I was going to go...
Right.
I was originally going to go with frozen Coke, because to me, a frozen Coca-Cola looks like the baby food paste in RoboCop. But then I realized something. Living in Austin, we have a pizza place called Via 313 that is Detroit-style pizza that has a pizza called the Detroiter that is fucking amazing. And the whole time I was watching RoboCop, it's deep dish and it's square, and it's like a personal pizza that's a perfect rectangle. And the whole time I'm watching RoboCop, I'm like, all I want to be doing right now is drinking beer and eating a Detroiter pizza, which seems like the perfect pairing for the movie, because nobody wants to eat baby food.
You know what's weird? I just now realized about RoboCop something I've never thought about, and why would you? Aside from baby food, there are no scenes of eating in this movie. Like, there's nobody, like, there's no sitting down to dinner. There's no, like,
but
one guy's drinking wine, and then RoboCop eats baby food, and, like, everything else is discussed in boardrooms or over Coke.
I'm going to assume that that's intentional, because almost every time you see eating in cinema, it's a moment of humanity. It's a moment of communion. It's a moment of making somebody real to you, and everybody's a walking stereotype.
Or it's because in this film, you either subsist on a baby food-like substance or a diet of pure uncut Colombian cocaine.
Yeah.
So that could also be what's going on.
Or if you count the second film, Nuke.
Cocaine. It's evil people baby food.
I'd buy that for a lot
dollar.
Of dollars.
I'll buy that for a dollar.
I'll buy that for
I
a dollar.
I like it.
An ounce. Mr. Brushwood, thank you so much.
Thanks for being here.
Dude, this can't be the last time. I've got to invade your privacy all again.
Oh, please. 100%. We'd love to have you back.
100%. Prime Directive 22. I can't remember which number I'm on. Will be to have you back on this show again.
Okay, right on.
Tell people where they can find you on the internet, what you're involved in.
What do you have going on right now? You've got so much.
I'll tell you what, man. Out of everything I've ever done, nothing I have been more proud of than The Modern Rogue. Me and Jason Murphy are on a quest to become the ultimate gentleman, warrior, and scoundrel in the 21st century. If Houdini, Magnum P.I., and James Bond had a baby, it would be The Modern Rogue, and we try to figure out everything that person would know at youtube.com/modernrogue.
And I gotta say,
Cargill, you held those cue cards really well for that.
Thank you.
Good job. Longtime listeners know that Jason Murphy is my closest friend on the planet, and I delight in watching him and Brian do shit that they shouldn't, that you should not be doing in a garage.
I'll buy that for $1.
Making the kind of things like, hey, you know what? This weekend we're going to show you how to make napalm and hope that we don't burn our eyebrows off. Like, hey, here's a drone we're going to play around with that's going to slice open my hand.
Yeah, all right, now you're getting personal.
And well,
what's inside this baseball?
and it is such a great fun series. I love that you guys do it. I loved your Netflix show that you guys did.
Oh, sure. Hacking the System just left Netflix. Unfortunately, that just expired on there, but you can buy it on Amazon and all of those places.
But I love that this is Netflix. This is Hacking the System on crack.
Between You, Me, and the Wall, almost everything we're doing on The Modern Rogue is stuff that did not get approved by standards and practices for Hacking the System. A very big pile
and now
of
we're learning why
stuff.
One quick thing, speaking of burning things down you didn't intend to, we didn't talk about the fact that a lot of this movie, RoboCop, was shot in Dallas, you know, not far from us right now.
That is right.
And one thing that happened is there was an explosion that Paul Verhoeven shot of a gas station where they pissed off the city of Dallas and almost got shut down because the explosion was so big it actually set fire to buildings that weren't part of the shoot. After which Verhoeven said, I don't think that explosion is big enough to read on camera. And his second unit director said, wait for the dailies before you blow anything else up, because I promise you it's big enough to read on camera.
That's amazing. I know that the second one they shot in Houston as the backdrop. Both Dallas and Houston, and of course this is old hat to folks who live in Texas, but both of those cities were developed during the modernist period, so you get a very consistent look. Austin's kind of the outlier in that it's very postmodern because most of the skyscrapers weren't built until the late 80s or whatever, but it was interesting. The moment that you see Murphy before he's RoboCop doing the TJ laser stuff, you can see the very recognizable X pattern of the lights in the skyscraper behind him.
I'd also like to point out, moving back towards this, you also have a weekly show called Night Attack on Twitch on Tuesday nights, where occasionally you can find me popping up.
Heck yeah, dude. As a matter of fact, if you want to see Robert Cargill, maybe a few scotches in when he calls in for the after show, join us every Tuesday night as we set the internet on fire for a little show called Night Attack at nightattack.tv.
Does that fire read on camera? That is what I want to know.
Only one way to find out.
Speaking of Cargill, which he does a lot, but where can people find you on the internet?
If you were me, why wouldn't you? You can find me on Twitter, at Massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM, or at Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm. Also, this is, you know what? I'm going to start this now. We are into June and July, and this September, early September, September 5th, guys, I got a new book coming out. It's called Sea of Rust. I'm really proud of it. People think it's the best thing that I've done in a while. I'm really hoping you guys agree. Pre-order it. You can find it wherever you buy books. It's called Sea of Rust.
Is this a sequel or in the same universe as that other book? Or
No. It's a standalone. It is a science fiction. It's a post. It is junky as fuck. It was written for my junk food cinema listeners. It is 30 years after the death of humanity, after the robots have wiped us out. They are dealing with their own shit with each other. It's a post-apocalyptic robot western. And I hope you guys like it.
It's a sequel to Rusty Zipper. Also, if you like junk food cinema, I'll go ahead and say this as well. We are going to be at the Alamo Draft House in Omaha, Nebraska on August 12th. We are kicking
off. We're coming to the breadbasket of America.
We are, and we're very excited to be hosting a four-movie action junkie movie marathon. They're not releasing the titles. They're going to be kind of a surprise, but I think they've started selling tickets for that. You can go to drafthouse.com and check that out. But we will be there for the entire weekend hosting the movies.
And by the way, I'm going to be in Minneapolis after the 4th of July for Convergence. At the end of July, you can find me in Honolulu at Honolulu Comic-Con. We're going to be doing Junk Food Cinema Live at Armadillo Con at the beginning of August.
That's here the weekend right before Omaha.
Before Omaha, right here in Austin, Texas. And I will be appearing as a guest at Dragon Con in early September. So if you want to get your junk food cinema fix, or you want to come in and chat movies with me, I will be around at these places.
We are going to put ourselves all up in your faces way more than you could possibly want.
It's the summer tour, baby.
It is. It is, in fact, the summer tour. So you can also go to patreon.com. I'm on Twitter at @BrightGuySalisbury. We're on Twitter at junkfoodcinema. patreon.com/junkfoodcinema if you want to support us. We really appreciate that.
Longest plug session ever. Let's move on to
The end. So podcast is done, so bitches, leave.